listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, in Old Milwaukee building, originally known as the Holton Street State Bank, will have a new purpose as a sober living residency. We'll talk to the organization's founder about its significance. Now, the U.S. Senate will vote on the For the People Act, a Democratic-backed package that would change voting procedures for federal elections. The bill, which passed the House earlier this year, would establish automatic voter registration, expand absentee voting options, and change campaign finance laws. Top Republicans call the legislation a Democratic power grab. Its supporters say it's needed to protect voting access, especially for minority voters. Georgia and Florida have passed new restrictions on absentee voting since the presidential election. And yesterday, Republicans in the Wisconsin State Senate passed bills that would require ballot gathering to happen near a clerk's office and bars clerks from filling in missing info on absentee ballots. Governor Evers said he'd veto those kind of bills. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you support a federal level bill that could override state rules on how we vote? Do you worry about the effect of limits on absentee voting, or do you think laws in Wisconsin and elsewhere need some clarification? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Paru Shah is an associate professor of political science at UW-Milwaukee. Paru, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
When you look at this bill at the federal level, what do you see as some of the most significant changes it would make if it were to pass, which is still an open question?
I think you pointed out a few of these in your introduction about how individual states at this point get to make a lot of decisions about how voting occurs in their states. And that leaves a lot of flexibility and discretion and differences, really, between how states decide to either make voting less restrictive or more restrictive. And this bill would really provide federal oversight and federal laws on what can and can't be done, and how to really think about managing voter voting opportunities and ensuring that voters are registered to vote, and creating, I think, some unified pathways for people to understand, like, these are the ways in which our voting rights are being upheld at the federal level.
Why is it that states have really called the shots in determining the particulars of how voting actually happens, even for federal, you know, say, congressional and presidential races?
I mean, that's just kind of the way the United States is set up in terms of federalism. And I think there's benefits to local control. I don't think that I would say that all local control is problematic. But what we saw in 1965 at the passage of the Voting Rights Act was that individual states will make decisions that disproportionately impact different groups. And you mentioned minority voters. I would argue that the types of accessibility issues that we've seen in this 2020 election are for lots of different kinds of folks, people who have transportation issues, people who have jobs where it is more difficult for them to get to the polls on a single day. The elderly, the young. And so finding ways to, at the federal level, to say, we value the vote of everybody, and how can we make it possible for more people to vote? And, you know, we saw in this 2020 election, in a year where people were expecting, because of COVID and other things, a decline in turnout, the greatest turnout we've ever seen for a presidential election. And so I think it goes to show that those kinds of structural changes where we increase the accessibility can really have a positive impact on voter turnout.
I want to give a listen to Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer talking about this bill in a committee hearing yesterday in the Senate. He said it was needed to protect voting access against the new state level restrictions we've touched on. Here's a bit of what he had to say.
Republican legislatures have seized on the big lie to restrict the franchise and inevitably make it harder for African Americans, Latinos, students, and the working poor to vote. Here in the 21st century, we are witnessing an attempt at the greatest contraction of voting rights since the end of Reconstruction and the beginning of Jim Crow.
Then at the same hearing, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said the bill amounts to a power grab by Democrats. Here's a listen to him.
This has gone from an election security bill to an ethics bill to a racial justice bill. Who knows what it'll be labeled tomorrow. But what doesn't change is the substance, because the intention doesn't change. The Democratic Party, on its own, wants to rewrite the ground rules of American politics for their benefit.
So, Paru, can you put this in context for us? Are we tinkering around the edges at the state and federal levels when it comes to voting? Or, as we just heard from both leaders in the Senate, are we looking at really fundamental changes that could shape future elections?
I would argue that, yes, these are fundamental changes. And if it was passed, I think that it would improve protections that, you know, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, while very successful at that time, the kinds of ways in which voters are disenfranchised now has really shifted. And so I think it really would have a fundamental effect. I do think, I mean, from my perspective, I think it's unfortunate to think of this as a Democrat or Republican policy or bill, but more to say, I would hope that both parties would be interested in ensuring as many people as possible could vote. And the evidence, you know, contrary to what the Republicans will tell you around voter fraud as a result of these expansions to voting are just not, you know, there's no evidence of that. And so I think, you know, that's the fraud. The fraud is that the lie of if we do these things, more people will, there'll be more voter fraud. And there's no evidence of that. So, and again, in a time when we, I think both parties, I would hope, would say, our democracy is stronger when more people can vote and share their perspectives and their opinions. I think we want to be moving towards that versus trying to find ways to make it more difficult.
We're talking to Paru Shah, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee, looking at proposed changes in federal voting laws that are before the U.S. Senate. Democrats passed the bill in the House. A Senate committee tackled the issue yesterday, deadlocked, because it's 9-9 in that committee. The future, who knows what it holds in the Senate on it. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you worry about what you see at state levels when it comes to tightening up some restrictions, especially on things like absentee or early voting? Do you want to see a federal law that overrides some of that, that sets standards, more standards from state to state? You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Paru, with an evenly divided Senate, Democrats having the tiebreaker, but the filibuster is still in existence. What are you looking at for the future of this this bill in the Senate and whether it could pass as it stands?
I mean, I think the question then becomes less about kind of the kind of substance of the bill and more now about the institution of the filibuster at the Senate. And, you know, I think we, I guess the, I should say the Democrats knew that going into this first term that, you know, this was going to be something that came up. And I think it's still, this would be, I think, the first test of whether or not we, the Democrats kind of think about like, all right, are they able to make some changes to some of these institutional structures, and do they have the backing to do so? You know, I don't know if I can, I feel confident that, you know, it's going to move forward, but I think it's going to at least push the conversation around whether or not the Democrats have, you know, the ability to make changes to the filibuster.
You mentioned earlier that you would hope that both parties would be able to agree on ways to make voting accessible and safe for everybody. But it seems like it's become this zero sum game where any change is going to be perceived by one party or the other as helping one party or the other. I don't know. How do you think they could get over that?
Well, I mean, I think that's the unfortunate piece around for the last, I don't know, maybe 8-12 years, the polarization of things that you would, you know, I think on its face, you would say are not partisan one way or the other. This idea that people should have the access to, you know, have access to the vote. I think for the most part, most individuals, regardless of their party affiliation, would agree with. It then becomes a question of, you know, like, what are some of the ways in which we can do that? And do I think that, you know, the outcomes of the 2020 election are influencing some of these decisions? I do. And so I think, you know, I think as people grapple with this idea that we had this, you know, impressive voter turnout. And then if for, you know, the side that feels like they lost because of that, right? Like, then the question becomes like, well, how can we make decision? You know, what can we do to change that? In an ideal world, the Republicans would, you know, put up better candidates and convince voters to vote for that candidate versus trying to say, I'm just going to change like who can vote and, you know, essentially limit the voter side of it versus thinking about how do I ensure, you know, that how do I put up candidates that speak to the constituents and convince people to vote for that person?
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Annette is with us in Madison. Annette, hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to underscore what your guest has said about voting fraud here in Wisconsin. And I have done canvassing throughout Wisconsin to try to get people who haven't previously been voters or consistently been voters to go to the polls, and there is no immediate personal incentive for people to do that. It's a very civic-minded public good behavior. The incentive to vote is being a good citizen, and many people just don't want to be part of any of that. So it's hard to convince people to vote. There's no incentive to commit fraud to vote. I worked in a bank as well, and where real fraud happens for the incentive of money. And I can tell you that people, they have never proven any evidence of voter fraud on a large scale basis. And I can tell you in talking to hundreds, maybe thousands of voters in Wisconsin, all over the state, there is no personal incentive. They don't see that getting a candidate elected has an immediate incentive in their lives per se, but when you talk about the public good of being a part of it, and any particular candidate might in a large scale way move the world better in the next 5 years, but I don't even understand what the incentive is to vote.
Annette, I would take your point. Thanks for calling in. Paru, what do you think of Annette's perspective?
Yeah, I mean, I think she brings up a great point about kind of this idea that for the most part, you know, voting in the United States is difficult. There are many, many kind of hoops to jump through to get to that point of being able to cast your ballot. And when we only had one day to do that, that was really, I think, in many ways restrictive. And, you know, all of the things that happened in 2020 as a result of COVID were policies and practices that were, you know, thought of before that. You know, this idea that we would have more absentee ballots, that people would have to opt out of registration versus opt in. Those aren't new ideas. It's just, you know, I think what happened in 2020 was that we were forced to make some decisions around that. And she makes, I think, a great point about how voting is, you know, still, I think, for many people, a additional thing to do. And so the idea that individuals would, you know, try to do some large scale kind of fraud, I think is one, very difficult to do given all the security systems we have. And we have a fantastic election security system in the United States. And two, just seems, I think, on its face, pretty unlikely given, you know, other, like what the benefits are to you as an individual voter.
Annette, thanks for the call. We're talking to Paru Shah, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee, looking at the voting bill considered now in the U.S. Senate. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of what's called the For the People Act? Do you want to see the federal government set more guidelines for states on things like early voting, absentee voting? Are there changes you'd like to see here in Wisconsin? Are there changes you're worried about seeing here in Wisconsin when it comes to the way we vote? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our talk now with Paru Shah, political science professor at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, looking at the Federal Voting Law Act being taken up in the U.S. Senate. It would expand things like absentee voting options and create automatic voter registration, among other changes. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you vote in a different way in 2020 than you had in past years? What do you think about some of the new options that were on the table, in large part because of COVID-19? Do you want to see changes in voting laws in Wisconsin and or nationwide? Call 800-642-1234. 1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll go back to your calls now. Jane is with us in Green Bay. Jane, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I have a tendency to look at things from the back view. So in this case, Democrats are trying to offer opportunities to vote more, which should be, you know, a lot of their constituents. What are the Republicans saying as far as would this bill disallow their voters, or would it not expand voting abilities to their voters? What are they concerned with? How are we outnumbering each other?
Jane, thanks for the call. And I know in the run-up to the 2020 elections, there were concerns from Republicans that then-President Trump's criticism of absentee and mail voting might actually depress their own turnout. In some cases, there were concerns. What do you think of Jane's question, Peru?
No, I think it's a fantastic question. And I think it is a question that I think the Republicans have to answer. I would say that the polling that I've seen shows that voters on both sides, I should say, are interested in expanding voter kind of registration and opportunities to vote. I think what I hear the Republicans really saying is that even if we do some of these, you know, like what we did here in Wisconsin in terms of changing absentee voting, that it's not going to have, it's not going to depress enough of the vote that people would still be able to, you know, look and say, okay, well, now I can't use that method, I'll use another method, and I'll continue to kind of move forward with, you know, the options given to me, versus saying, you know, that by expanding this, you know, you're just giving people more opportunities to vote and lengthening the time in which they can do so. So, I mean, you're not going to hear any of the Republicans say, oh, we want less people to vote, even though that I think is the outcome that will, you know, occur from these kinds of restrictive laws. But that rather that we, even within these laws, the voters who really care about it will still show up.
Thanks a lot for that call. I pulled up a chart of the most popular votes attained by presidential candidates in American history. All the elections. Number one was Joe Biden in 2020 with 81 million plus. Number two was Donald Trump in 2020 with 74 million plus. A lot of people. Barack Obama, by the way, number three and four. A lot of people voted in this election on both sides, Peru. I don't know. What do you make of just that raw vote number on both sides?
Well, I mean, this is what I was saying earlier, that I think that while Republicans are using the fraud argument, what has actually happened is that both sides benefited, right? All voters benefited from the changes in the election laws that increased, you know, availability. And again, the focus, this idea that, you know, it's really helping this particular group of folks like racial minorities. Yes, they are, I think, a group that is historically disenfranchised by voter laws. But it also helped people who lived in rural places, people who had less access to transportation, older individuals. And those are all folks who potentially are not voting for Democrats. So I think, again, if the true kind of interest here is to ensure that every voter who wants to vote can do that, I think it benefits both parties.
Let's go back to our callers now. Carol is with us in Milwaukee. Carol, hi.
Hi. I think it also includes more things besides just voting. I think it includes that new law would include the Citizens United problem, where endless dark money is given to candidates and things like that. I think there's more to the new law, isn't there?
Carol, thanks for bringing that up. That is, there's a provision that would require disclosure of a lot of money that is put into political spending that isn't currently required to be disclosed, Peru. I don't know as much about that, but is that something you're keeping your eye on as well?
Yeah, and I think, you know, this is one of those times where I think to some of the kind of comments that we heard earlier from when you were kind of sharing from Congress, right? Like this idea, like, oh, this bill keeps expanding. It does include campaign finance reform as well, to the caller's comment. And I think it's something, again, that there has been bipartisan support for in the past. This idea that we want to have a better understanding of, one, like where money is coming from in terms of campaigns, and two, to really enhance the power of small donations for candidates. And so in the past, this has been something that I would argue, you know, both Republicans and Democrats have been interested in. And you know, is I think, another significant part of this bill.
Thanks, Carol, for the call. In our last minute or so, Paru, are there other provisions or things happening at state levels that you have your eye on that we haven't gotten into yet?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of, when I think about kind of the ways in which this bill is similar to the Voting Rights Act of 1965, you know, like that bill passes and then there's a flurry of state level kind of attempts to undermine it. And I would say that similarly, since 2020, I think we're looking at over 100 state level bills looking to restrict voter access. And some of them are things like we see here in Wisconsin, where it's really restricting what the clerks can do and absentee ballots. And then, you know, I think the one in Georgia about providing water and food to people waiting in line, right? Like all these kind of different kinds of bills that on their face really do look like ways in which we're really trying to kind of change fundamentally what happened in 2020. And rather than seeing that as a positive indicator of how, as the United States, we were able to overcome a pandemic and ensure voting for more people than ever, as a way, rather seeing that as like evidence that too many people, you know, it actually worked too well. And so I am concerned that a lot of these state level restrictions will continue. And given the, you know, I think probably unsure where HR1 is going to go and the unclear passage of that, I think those things will continue to be a concern.
Paru, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Paru Shah, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee, joining us for a look at the For the People Act, a bill now in the U.S. Senate on voting reforms. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Colonial Pipeline Company says it's working to restore operations after its East Coast pipeline was shut down by a ransomware cyber attack. Coming up, we'll look at what happened, who's believed to be responsible, and how prepared U.S. infrastructure is against those kind of attacks. Now, a Milwaukee building on the edge of the Harambe and River West neighborhoods has a long history, from a bank to a hostel. Now, a Milwaukee organization has moved in, planning to convert the space into expanded housing and new headquarters for a sober living facility. Jason Gonzalez is the founder and CEO of Fourth Dimension Sobriety, based in the River West neighborhood of Milwaukee. Jason, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Jason, could you share your story of what led you into trying to find good housing situations for people trying to be sober?
Yeah, well, for me, it came from a just personal experience of sobriety. Got sober in 2008, and after 5 years of sobriety, I started looking around and trying to figure out what more I could do with the gift that was given to me. You know, I really thought that and believed that every day was an extra day, and so I needed to give back somehow. And I looked around, and what do I got? And at the time, I had a duplex that I was currently living in, and I just invited people in. I got two beds, and I put it in my house, and I invited people in to live with me. And over time, developed more and more structure, and then an organization and community just started growing.
And give us a sense of what this sober living community is like and what it means for the people who move in.
Yeah, I mean, it's a safe place for people who are seeking freedom from drugs and alcohol, delusion, you know, anybody that really wants you know, peace, serenity, and connection. That's what we're about. So we have structure that's included in the living aspects of not only do they live with us, but there's structure from morning meditation, some job work experience. Some people go to treatment, and then the evening is spent doing 12-step work and more meditation. Sprinkle in there a lot of community building stuff, and you know, that's kind of the basis of Fourth Dimension.
And when I think of, you know, a recovery center, I guess an image of something really clinical pops into my head. My understanding here is you're going for something with kind of a home feel.
Yeah, we're and there's nothing wrong with the clinical feel, but, you know, a lot of people who've been in sobriety and tried it over and over again, the last thing they need is to enter into another institution. And what we really want is a house of hospitality. We're inviting people to live in this community and take ownership of their home and their lives. And so we really want to provide them with you know, the sense of home. So you're coming into your home. This is your community. Take ownership of this, not only your sobriety, but everybody.
Now take us, Jason, into this new building, kind of a cool looking building, a lot of history, a bank, a hostel, and a lot of things in between. Give us a tour and what it means for your efforts.
It means a lot. So right now, like I said, we're occupied, or we're living in separate homes in River West, small communities that, you know, in the River West neighborhood, residential homes. And so what this is going to provide is not only a bigger space for more people to live in, but also a better space for us to run our holistics out of. So I mentioned that we have meditation, but we also, you know, we have yoga, we have drum circles, we have community dinners, and we have a bunch of stuff that has to do with our internal community, that helps our internal community. We want to use this space not only for our internal community, but to open it up to everybody. You know, it was once a bank, like you said, and banks are supposed to invest in the communities that they're in. And I think that this building, you know, it's still the same purpose. It's just going to invest in a different way. It's going to reinvest in the community in a different way.
So this is a big project in some ways. How is it going? Where are you in terms of having it ready and having people move in?
People are in.
Okay.
We moved this weekend. I think it was like 5 residents are there right now. We got another guy coming tomorrow and a guy coming at the end of the week. It's, you know, we're moving. Once we get settled with, you know, the living situation, then I'm going to start the programming. We started with some rooms on the second floor, and as fundraising develops, we're going to occupy the rest of the rooms in the building. But it was once a hostel. So there's a lot of community spaces that we're also using right now. So it's good. It's perfect for what we're looking for.
Jason, big picture, you're a local community resident. You saw a need in your community and you step-by-step tried to help address that need. For other people around the state who might be listening and thinking, you know, whether it's sobriety or something completely different, maybe there's a little something I can do to make a difference. What would you say to them to take that first step and actually try to do it?
You know, do what I did. I looked and I tried to figure out what do I have, right? And at the time I had $500 and in an extra room in my house. That's what I had. And so you just have to take that step, right? That leap of faith. Do something and don't wait. You know, not to say that there's nothing wrong with planning. That's definitely important. But don't let the planning get in the way of the vision.
Jason, thank you so much for joining us. Good luck with this project.
Hey, thank you so much.
That's Jason Gonzalez, founder and CEO of Fourth Dimension Sobriety, based in the River West neighborhood of Milwaukee. He joined us to talk about converting the old Holston Street Bank building, goes back to 1927, into headquarters and more sober living space for his organization's work. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about preserving memories of floods.
In recent years, Wisconsin's Driftless region has experienced some of the most severe flooding in its history. The new podcast from our partners at Wisconsin Humanities, called Human Powered, is exploring that issue in one of its episodes. Here's host Jimmy Gutierrez.
One night in late August of 2018, it started to rain in southwestern Wisconsin. That rain quickly turned into a downpour and then a flash flood. Ryan McGuire is a firefighter in Coon Valley. His pager starts going off at 11 p.m., and by 1 a.m., he's making his first rescue.
So she goes to open up her door. Now, by this time, the water's about midway in between my knees and my hip, and I'm 6 foot. And we always tell them, grab your phone, grab anybody that's in there, and grab any medications because we don't know if we're coming back.
These floods have devastated low-lying communities like Coon Valley and others in the Driftless region, and they keep coming. In the last 15 years, there have been at least five so-called 100-year floods. It has people asking, how can we continue to live here?
A project called Stories from the Flood could be one of the answers. Started 2 years ago by the Driftless Writing Center, volunteers and community members have interviewed over 100 people about their experiences during flood events. These stories share grief, resilience, and even joy, but they also give us the ability to think about complex issues like flooding and climate change in a brand new way. Today, we're heading back to the Driftless region with Caroline Gottschalk-Druschke. Caroline is an associate professor of rhetoric and composition at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
I think folks who haven't experienced floods think about them maybe as a one-day event or two-day or 1 week. And really, you know, 2.5 years later now, people are still cleaning things out, rebuilding things, tearing things down. It is clear that people are super traumatized. And what if we try to help people express that and share it and understand that they're not alone in it?
People wanted to talk. People needed to talk. So Caroline and other volunteers started recording stories. And Caroline got her students involved. They heard stories of resilience, stories of hope, and also pain. For Ryan McGuire, the night of the flood is a memory he'll never forget.
I don't want to say you have PTSD, but you get flashbacks. I can go right back to that night. I can picture the... I'm there. I mean, I'm walking down the street and the water's up to my chest and, you know, see like a shiver in your back and, you know, and I don't know if it doesn't scare me, but it's just, I'm there.
Many of those storytellers then did give feedback saying that it was a really important experience for them. And it was important to be able to tell and to think through and to narrate what had happened to them. And then putting that experience in some context and putting it in connection with other people who also experienced something really, really hard right alongside of them.
It also helped her students as they themselves struggled through a school year like no other.
A lot of my students in the spring and fall said that listening to the flood stories helped them make it through COVID. Like, there was something powerful in the ways that people face something really overwhelming and awful and kind of find their way through it that gave my students a lot of peace when they were going through a similar kind of situation. And that's something that science doesn't necessarily do. You know, science helps point us towards an answer, but I think, yeah, stories can give us equipment for living, if you will.
That story came to us from Human Powered, a new podcast from Love Wisconsin and Wisconsin Humanities. The 6 episodes of Human Powered share stories from people in communities across Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we'll take a look at how vulnerable U.S. infrastructure is to cyber attacks and who's most likely to try. That's next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, Mahjong is a game played by millions, but what can this Chinese pastime teach us about our own history? Jen White finds out today at 6 on 1A+. Now, the Biden administration and members of Congress are calling for more oversight of America's pipelines. That comes less than a week after a major pipeline that carries gas and jet fuel to the East Coast was taken offline by a cyber attack. Reports this afternoon that the line is coming back online. The FBI says the ransomware attack was carried out by an Eastern European group known as DarkSide. In recent years, banks, hospitals, universities, and city governments have been hit by such attacks. A security firm tells the Washington Post that last year alone, nearly 2,400 organizations were victims. Tyler Moore is the Tandy Professor of Cybersecurity and Information Assurance at the University of Tulsa. His areas of expertise include cybercrime measurement and cybersecurity policy. Tyler, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
Well, what do we know about this pipeline attack? What are you watching for here?
Well, in many ways, it's another run-of-the-mill ransomware attack. As you said, 2,400 attacks last year. The criminals go in, they infect computers on an enterprise network, and then lock the data till you give them the money. And what's interesting to me about this one is the preemptive shutdown of the pipelines has seemed to be causing most of the havoc, and it'll be interesting to see when they can actually bring it back online and whether or not they've actually rooted out the cause of the infection when it does come online.
How vulnerable are we in this country for critical stuff like our pipelines and hospitals and so forth to being successfully targeted by these ransomware groups?
Well, I mean, I think the evidence is pretty clear that we're quite vulnerable. Especially things like critical infrastructures, hospitals, these are organizations that prioritize availability. And it's really important to make these systems available. And so attackers know this, and they target them because that they're going to hit us where it hurts. And we often introduce vulnerabilities into our system to make them available, which makes it easier for them to compromise them in the first place.
A lot of ransomware attacks are the kind where the hackers get into your system and basically they shut down your access to your data. You want to get up and running again, you got to pay them. Another case here, more disturbing maybe, Washington, D.C. hackers releasing sensitive data about the city's police department, personnel files, threatening to release undercover investigation notes, things like that, if they're not paid. Are we seeing more of that kind of approach?
Yeah, this is definitely an interesting twist. I mean, ransomware has been around for better part of a decade. And yeah, the playbook used to be you just encrypt the data. People can't access it. If you don't pay, it's gone forever. I think they've stumbled onto another way to make it hurt, which is to, threaten to disclose information. And we've seen this happen in other cases. Some universities have been hit. There have been, attempts to threaten that they would threaten they'd release student records unless the ransoms were paid. And here in the DC case, it's, police personnel files that were disclosed. And what we're really seeing is just a ratcheting up of the pressure from the gangs to try to extort larger and larger ransoms.
Who's doing this stuff?
Well, I mean, it seems to be cyber criminal gangs, which, are predominantly based in Eastern European countries. And, these groups, are profit motivated. So, whereas, in years past, they might have focused on phishing attacks to try to steal banking credentials or advanced free frauds, they've now really honed in on ransomware as the most profitable activity, because instead of, stealing a little bit of money out of an individual's bank account, they can hit organizations and, get hundreds of thousands of dollars per infection, which is quite attractive.
Talking to Tyler Moore from the University of Tulsa, cybersecurity expert there, talking about ransomware attacks. The big one in the news, this oil pipeline, not the only one out there, though, lots of others over the last year or so. Tyler, President Biden said his administration would begin 100-day initiatives focused on making things like pipelines and water and other sectors more protected. If they called you up, what would you tell them to do?
Well, I think that, it's true that, our critical infrastructures need to have a greater investment in security. I think there's a lot of what we know needs to be done is out there. There's basic cyber hygiene that needs to be put in place. It's just a matter of making the investment to do so. It's unfortunately pretty expensive in many cases for enterprises to keep up. And so I think, the policy we should be considering for improving cybersecurity is placing more of an expectation of investment into security among our critical infrastructure operators. Right now, everything is voluntary and, people do their best, but without sort of a duty to make the investment and an obligation to do so, some unfortunately will not.
How about the money supply here? Are there things we could do to take the profit motive that you say was motivating these gangs out of the equation?
Sure. I think in the case of ransomware in particular, we really have to get our heads around these escalating ransoms. It's getting completely out of control. Just a few years ago, ransoms were only costing a few single thousands of dollars, which may seem like a lot, but you know, in 2020, the average ransom paid out was over $300,000, and it just keeps going up. And so the way we're going to get ahead of ransomware in particular is to try to make these ransoms not be paid at the rates that they are. So we need to, you know, establish some norms or perhaps even some laws that would require, you know, forbid the paying of ransom, and making it much less attractive for these kind of attacks that happen in the first place.
Well, that seems tough if I'm running a hospital and my patient records are suddenly encrypted and I can't get into them. I don't know. I think I'd be willing to pay.
Oh, absolutely. And that's the rub, right? So if you are an individual operator, then it makes perfect sense. The calculus is that, you know, you've been attacked. You want to fix this problem. And so you're going to pay up. And that's why in every individual organization is typically making that calculation. But when you look at it by taking a step back from the societal perspective, it's not good because every hospital that pays or every city or pipeline that pays makes it more likely that the next city, hospital or pipeline is going to be targeted. And so we have to get in front of this by making it, you know, making these ransoms no longer a viable way for the criminals to make money.
I understand a lot of these, all of these maybe are being paid in cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin. Was that kind of an essential ingredient in making these attacks work?
Absolutely. I mean, you can't pay a multi-$100,000 ransom on a credit card. And if you try to pay it through a wire transfer, you know, those kind of payments will get blocked or reversed. And so, you know, Bitcoin is an essential ingredient here for this to work because it's a non-revocable transaction that's hard to trace. And so the criminals absolutely use Bitcoin because without Bitcoin, how else could someone in Eastern Europe be able to extort money from organizations in the United States? So that's definitely an issue.
Now, how about us individuals? Are we vulnerable to this kind of ransomware attack?
Well, you know, when ransomware started, going about, 18 years ago, individuals did get targeted with ransomware. But that's much less common now. And the reason why is that, you know, the criminals have realized that they have deeper pockets to go after, right? So organizations are much more likely to pay and have more resources to pay. And one big reason for that is because many organizations and municipalities have cyber insurance. And the cyber insurance typically will cover the costs of a ransomware incident, including paying out the ransom itself.
In our last minute or so, we've seen cities like Oshkosh and Racine here in Wisconsin hit by this, your own hometown, Tulsa, dealing with a ransomware attack. If somebody's in a city running a local government, what would you tell them to do to prepare for and hopefully prevent a ransomware attack in the future?
So, cities have a hard job in front of them. They tend to have very low budgets in IT compared to the private sector. And so that makes them a better target for attackers. And so essentially what, the advice to try to deal with or prevent a ransomware attack is to make investments to update software and to maintain good backups of your systems. And that advice is good, but it requires investment. And so what ultimately that's going to mean is that the citizens in these cities are going to have to recognize that it's going to take added investment in your city IT infrastructure, which unfortunately is going to cost money. And so if we want to be secure, we're going to have to pay for it.
Tyler, thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Tyler Moore is the Tandy Professor of Cybersecurity and Information Assurance at the University of Tulsa. We talked to him about the ransomware attack against a fuel pipeline along the east coast of the U.S. and how prepared America's infrastructure, local governments, and businesses are when it comes to future attacks, which there will be, it sounds like. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 8, Kate and her guests dig into a piece of Wisconsin beer history with the first Black-owned brewery in the state. Hear the story of People's Brewing in Oshkosh tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll talk about the Republican vote to strip Liz Cheney of her leadership post in the U.S. House today and about a meeting President Biden had with leaders from Congress. It's all part of our weekly look at the top stories in Washington. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.